Support for WYPR comes from the Park School of Baltimore's Saturday morning Rise and Shine activity sessions for children 3 to 5 years of age. Nature expedition through the Park School woods is April 20th. parkschool.net/shine.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Skimming drugs and cash from crime scenes, planting evidence, stealing thousands in overtime pay. The Baltimore police officers on the Gun Trace Task Force felt empowered to serve themselves, not the community. And the crimes of this plainclothes unit went unchecked for years, becoming more brazen as the department's dysfunction offered a shield to hide what they were doing. We Own This City, a true story of crime, cops, and corruption, is Baltimore Sun crime reporter Justin Fenton's first book. HBO has announced that Josh Charles, Jamie Hector, and John Bernthal have been cast to star in a limited series by that name, a good reason for us to revisit our conversation with Fenton from February. Fenton opened We Own This City with a letter from an inmate in federal prison in West Virginia from 2017. I asked him to tell us about this letter.
Yeah, in the fallout of the Gun Trace Task Force indictments, people started to come forward saying that they had been victims of these officers, that they were sitting in prison for crimes that they didn't commit. And one in particular was a man named Umar Burley, who 7 years earlier had been charged with having heroin and having fled police, causing an accident that killed an elderly man. But there was much more to the story. And it would, you know, as the investigators picked away at it, it would come to include new charges and also be a focal point of an officer's high profile death, the shooting of Detective Sean Suter. So I open with that story because really it sets the scene for, you know, much more to come.
So Burley, basically seeing the coverage of the Gun Trace Task Force, realized that's what happened to him, and he gets his case thrown out essentially, although he's already served time.
Yeah, he was exonerated for that, as was his co-defendant, Brent Matthews. You know, his story is emblematic of so many others that I came across in my research, which is essentially folks who said that things had been done wrong to them. Officers had lied about circumstances and that, you know, they didn't even speak up because they didn't think anybody was going to listen to them. You know, it was interesting to even talk to defense attorneys who said that, who said, you know, it's not even worth saying that stuff because no one's going to believe it.
Yeah, the pretext for the squad pulling up on Burley was that Jenkins said, Sergeant Wayne Jenkins said, it looked like the passenger got into the car with cash. And you're saying this basically was a typical incident of behavior by GTTF.
The Baltimore Police Department for decades has utilized plainclothes officers. And I want to be clear, those are officers who are wearing street clothes. It doesn't mean they're undercover officers. It's just something that's supposed to give them an advantage on essentially sneaking up on people and catching people in the act of doing something. But in reality, oftentimes they are using traffic stops or stopping people in the street with no real pretext and trying to, you know, see if they can catch them with guns or drugs. And a lot of those lead to encounters where someone is not doing anything wrong. And that leads to a lot of the, you know, poor ties with the community that we continue to see now, in which they're trying to fix with a consent decree. And it remains to be seen whether they'll be able to do that.
Well, what was this unit supposed to be doing? What was the mission of the Gun Trace Task Force?
The unit's mission, they were created in the late 2000s, around 2007, to be essentially to try to duplicate the efforts of federal officials, try to do more quality investigations of gun traffickers, not stopping people on the street, but doing these complex investigations. They actually had members of the Maryland State Police and Baltimore County Police at that time, and they were supposed to try to get people who are trafficking guns in high numbers into this city. But around 2014, you know, there was a consultant's report done for the police department that essentially said, hey, you know, these guys aren't doing enough. You know, we need them to be more proactive. And that set the stage for the Gun Trace Task Force that Wayne Jenkins would take over, which and essentially was, you know, it came to light that they were stopping dozens of people in a given night for things like seatbelt violations, for having driven off of a gas pump and being 5 feet away from the pump and being pulled over for not having their seatbelt on. You know, the leaders in the police department liked what they did. They liked the number of guns that they were getting on the street. And I talked to officers in my reporting who said, you know, every morning we would get emails about how many guns the Gun Trace Task Force had taken off the street. And it didn't make sense. They were getting too many. You know, maybe they were good, but they weren't that good. But it really didn't raise questions within the police department the way it should have. They liked those results. And there was even commanders who said, hey, can you teach other squads how to do what you're doing? We want more like this.
So Sergeant Wayne Jenkins was promoted to head the Gun Trace Task Force in 2016. He was ultimately sentenced to 25 years in federal prison for robbery, overtime fraud, planting evidence, among other charges. Tell us more about the illegal techniques Jenkins passed down to his squad. What were some of his methods?
Yeah, one of the officers from his squad who was convicted and is currently in federal prison, you know, outlined for me how Jenkins taught them and explained to them how to cut corners, how to steal things without getting caught. You know, in the book, I try to trace Jenkins' career with the policies of the police department. So really, the story is actually sort of a 15-year, 20-year story explaining how he came to the department during zero tolerance when there was, you know, 100,000 people being arrested per year. And Jenkins was a part of that. He made over 300 arrests himself in 1 year, at least 300. And then as the agency tried to back off zero tolerance and to more focusing on violent repeat offenders, as they called it, you know, he transferred into the units that did that. As plainclothes officers have always been a part of the agency, different names, different incarnations of it. But the officers who worked in this unit said it was always the same type of work. It was this aggressive, you know, on the prowl. They even used the word hunting, you know, in court to describe it prior to getting caught. They were so comfortable that was okay, that was an okay way to describe it.
Well, you said it didn't really raise the red flags that it should have, this behavior. How did Jenkins endear himself to commanders gain the trust inside the department?
Yeah, one of the things that I found was just going through his emails through you know, Freedom of Information requests, was the way he made sure to always point out what his team was accomplishing. You know, there was regular emails sent by Jenkins to the entire agency, to his bosses, you know, highlighting their work, asking for things such as new cars, new equipment, and they liked what he was doing. So even when he got in trouble, you know, he was able to he was very assertive in trying to explain that these things were lies. He got cleared of a wrongdoing case that almost got him in real trouble. And instead of just moving on, he actually wrote a memo to the investigators saying that, like, they shouldn't have done that. That it was very unprofessional of them to go after him because he's a good officer. He was not somebody, even though his misconduct operated in the shadows, he was in the spotlight of this agency.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Baltimore Sun criminal justice reporter Justin Fenton about his book, We Own This City. It chronicles the rise and fall of a corrupt police unit within the Baltimore Police Department. Jenkins' colleagues were not strangers to bending the rules. He had trained under two officers with histories of unlawful searches and lying. When Detective Daniel Hursel joined the squad, the Gun Trace Task Force, the city had already paid out $200,000 to settle lawsuits for his brutal behavior. And there was Detective Maurice Ward, a 12-year veteran, when he joined Jenkins' squad. Tell us about Ward.
Yeah, Ward is one of the members of the task force who opened up to me, and he, you know, he was very open about the fact that he felt as though he had to do things like take money to fit in, that it was hard to get promoted into these units, and that officers did these things, and that's how you showed that you were one of the guys. You know, he described sort of a more casual skimming of money that occurred during his career in the plainclothes units that sort of went on steroids when he joined Jenkins' squad. The stuff they were doing with Jenkins, I think he says that he was uncomfortable by it. He claims that he discarded money that was taken from one particularly large bus because it was just too much and he didn't feel comfortable with it. You know, there's a lot of talk in this case about planting of evidence, and there are some documented cases of planting evidence, but there's usually, for the ones that have been borne out, you know, they're sort of planting evidence as a means to an end, you know, getting out of a jam, justifying something that they did. There's a lot of claims out there that guns were planted on people with regularity. You know, Ward, for his part, and you can take it with a grain of salt if you like, he says that, you know, it wasn't really that's not something that he did. He confesses to a lot of crimes, but not that. And so, and I think that's emblematic of how much we still don't know about this case. And I try to convey that to the reader in the book that, you know, that there's so much, it's hard to know even now which claims are true, you know, which crimes have not been uncovered yet. Officers who may have been involved or maybe knew about it and aren't willing to tell the truth. There's still a lot that we don't know about this case and people who've not been brought to justice.
In 2016, the Gun Trace Task Force was praised for seizing 132 handguns and making 110 arrests for handgun violations in just 9 months. Was that just a matter of odds because they pulled over so many cars and searched so many people?
Right, yeah. And that's the way Ward described it during the trial when he was on the witness stand. He said that it was a numbers game. You know, you pull over more people, you're likely to get more guns. And sometimes they would report getting up to, you know, 5 in a night. But you had to put that in the context of they might have pulled over 50 people. In addition to the flimsy car stops, you know, they also would drive up on people standing around in groups doing something that they called door pops, where they would drive at them very fast and then slam on the brakes and pop the doors open. And if somebody ran, they believe that person was likely carrying something that they shouldn't have and would chase after them. So, you know, again, this proactive police work was really sort of fishing, trying to look for something. And a lot of people who weren't doing anything wrong would end up getting stopped and searched as a result.
And yet about 40% of Sergeant Jenkins' gun cases between 2012 and 2016 were dropped by prosecutors. Did that raise any red flags in the department?
It didn't, and it should have. I mean, this is a department that, you know, in my experience covering it, is, you know, there's a crisis every day. There's always something going on. There's always a high profile murder. There's always a scandal. There's always new, you know, things going on. And there's not enough reflection. And I think this showed that. And from prosecutors, too. I mean, the prosecutors who are discarding those cases have a role there to say, hey, you know, a lot of these guns, these gun cases, they're getting thrown out. Back before the scandal broke, I had done an analysis for the Baltimore Sun about gun cases. The commissioner at the time was complaining that too many didn't result in prison time. And what we found when we looked at them closely was that a lot of them were bad. It was, you know, they didn't withstand scrutiny when they got to court, but nobody was really circling back around to try to improve those outcomes or in individual cases sort of, you know, hold them to account for that.
That's Baltimore Sun crime reporter Justin Fenton here on The Record on WIPR. We're speaking about his book, We Own This City. Short break. When we're back, the fall of the Gun Trace Task Force. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay tuned.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Support for WYPR comes from the Park School of Baltimore's Saturday morning Rise and Shine activity sessions for children 3 to 5 years of age. Nature expedition through the Park School woods is April 20th. parkschool.net/shine.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Baltimore Sun crime reporter Justin Fenton sets his book, a detailed chronicle of the criminal exploits of the Baltimore Police Department's Gun Trace Task Force, in the context of the recent history of policing in the city. The death of Freddie Gray, the revolving door of Baltimore police chiefs, the U.S. Justice Department's investigation into police force. The book is titled We Own This City and is the basis for a limited series coming up on HBO. When we spoke in February, I asked Fenton to talk about a pivotal moment in his book when Baltimore County cops find GPS trackers on a car belonging to a drug dealer they are investigating.
Yes, so there was an investigation of a drug crew in Northeast Baltimore, and it was being investigated by a Harford County and Baltimore County a DEA squad. You know, they felt like a lot of drugs that were ending up in the suburbs were being dealt from the city. So, you know, in addition to the way the book looks at police corruption and the city's high murder rate, it's also the backdrop of the fentanyl overdose explosion and all the different people who were coming into the city to get drugs at that time and were overdosing. So that group is doing an investigation of a crew that they believe responsible. And after moving in to arrest one of the guys, they find a GPS tracker under his car. And it's not part of any sort of investigation. There's supposed to be databases where officers are entering information in so that they don't step on each other's toes. And they did a subpoena on this tracker and found out it was registered to a member of the Gun Trace Task Force. And from there, it started to bring into focus different things. The officers themselves, you know, had heard about Baltimore City police officers, and really they stumbled onto this. This did not come from a citizen complaint. It did not come from, you know, prosecutors or judges raising questions. The county investigators just sort of fell backwards into this.
And let me just make sure it's clear. Police are not allowed to slap GPS trackers on cars unless they have a warrant or an authorization from a judge, right?
Correct. Yes, they were supposed to have warrants for these. They did not. It was personally purchased by the officer, and it was in his name. And really, one of the federal prosecutors working that drug investigation said, you know, if they called us up and said, hey, that's our tracker, sorry about that. She said something to the effect of it was like teachers buying, you know, supplies for their class. They actually wouldn't have thought that much of it. Despite the fact that that's not supposed to happen. But no one ever came looking for the tracker. It sat in a drawer. And as the investigators started to look closer at this unit, they found some troubling ties to the very drug crew that they were investigating.
Well, Baltimore County cops were already wary of working with Sergeant Jenkins, right?
Yeah, that was an interesting thing. I was interviewing a Baltimore County investigator just to get more details about this aspect of their case. And one thing they said was that, you know, all the officers working in narcotics in Baltimore County knew that Wayne Jenkins and his mentor, Keith Gladstone, were bad news and to stay away from them. And, it's one of those things where, again, it's, you know, people say that, should people have known? And it sounds like people in Baltimore County at least had suspicions and concerns.
This discovery of the GPS trackers led to the FBI being pulled into the case, but it took years for the investigation to turn into charges. How did the FBI approach the case?
You know, this case actually, it's a very intense, like 8-month period, really. When they get up on the wiretap, it's, you know, in the late spring of 2016, and Jenkins is increasing his crimes at this point and really, you know, sort of out of control, some of his officers would later say. And then he goes on leave at the end of 2016 and everything sort of grinds to a halt. And, the charges are brought a few months later. So, I mean, one of the most amazing things about this case is that, you know, in Philadelphia, just a couple of years earlier, there's a similar case. And they charged a whole unit of plainclothes officers just like this. And the officers were acquitted. In the Baltimore case, the officers started cooperating, flipping, and giving all sorts of new insight and information just to how deep this all went. So, the way this case was handled by the U.S. Attorney's Office in Maryland is very fortunate that we were able to find out much, much more than just the actual investigation itself was able to uncover.
Well, one element I want to get to about 8 months before Jenkins and the other members of the GTTF were arrested. Jenkins showed up at a crime scene in the county with his friend and drug dealing partner, Donald Stepp. Tell us about Stepp.
Yeah. So, there's still a lot that is not known about Jenkins' crime, sort of when they began. But we know from his childhood friend, Donald Stepp, who's a bail bondsman, that Jenkins had come to him in 2012 and said, listen, I'm getting a lot of drugs off the street. And if I start bringing them to you, you know, do you think that you can sell them? And Stepp had experience selling cocaine and he had a client base for it. And he started to take drugs that Jenkins brought to him. So at least since 2012, this was going on and they were splitting the proceeds. It was straight profit. And that led to that memorable scene that Stepp told the federal authorities, which was that during the Freddie Gray unrest, uprising, riots, whatever people prefer to call them, that Jenkins had actually intercepted drugs stolen out of a pharmacy and that he took them to Stepp's house. He called him up in the middle of the night and popped open his trunk and showed him all this stuff that he'd been able to get while policing that unrest. So Stepp also flipped and gave a wealth of information. He gave a lot of information about, you know, sort of off-duty break-ins and being called to search scenes that Jenkins and his team were going to. And Jenkins would tell him, hey, break in there before we get there and clean the place out. So, I mean, it really is a staggering amount of crimes and allegations of crimes that were uncovered in this case.
Kevin Davis was police commissioner in 2017. What was his reaction when the FBI revealed the details of the case?
You know, he tells me that he was proud. He was proud that this had been uncovered on his watch. But, you know, it, eventually, you know, just the fact that it had been going on didn't bode well. You know, he talked about the difficulty of, you know, allegations and having to prove them. You know, there's officers he was warned of, but that, investigate. You had to have good information to actually bring charges against somebody. And there's one officer in particular that he highlights as somebody who, you know, he got information that this was a bad officer. He was able to fire him, but obviously there was many more, and Jenkins escaped scrutiny during his tenure as well.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Baltimore Sun criminal justice reporter Justin Fenton about his book, We Own This City, a remarkable look at the crimes of the city's elite plainclothes unit, the Gun Trace Task Force. You detail instances where officers are charged with misconduct internally, but the department just gives them a slap on the wrist. Officers go on to get promotions, to receive commendations, to continue with plainclothes work. No one ever gets fired. What do you make of this?
Yeah, I think a lot of this does have to do with transparency of the process. In Maryland, personnel laws extending to all employees, not just police, prevent the release of this information. And I think there's no way to really check on these cases to try to scrutinize them, see whether either someone, you know, committed misconduct and got a light punishment, or whether there was a credible accusation that didn't get pursued. But one of the things the officers who cooperated with federal authorities said was that they did not fear internal affairs. They feared, you know, officers who were maybe, you know, had been embedded with them as informants or something like that. But they really didn't think that if they got a complaint, that it was going to go anywhere. Conversely, one thing I hear from officers a lot too is that officers get in trouble for minor things that are insignificant, and that they get, you know, maybe picked on. And so it seems like they have trouble getting at the big things, while others say that they're focusing on small things. And it's something that every administration I've covered says that they're working on and they're fixing, and yet, you know, we continue to see problems.
As these officers were sentenced, one of the big questions was how many innocent people were behind bars because of them. What has it taken to clean up the mess that the GTTF left?
Yeah, so city prosecutors made a list of officers who they believe their integrity has been compromised. Those are, you know, officers who are caught up in the scandal, maybe those who had allegations against them, and began working to undo convictions. So there was hundreds of people that had their convictions tossed out. There's others who haven't been able to. And then there's cases where people, I think authorities have been pretty clear that they think these people are in fact guilty. And it's the officer's integrity questions that are, you know, causing the case to be thrown out. So it's like you got a mix of innocent people and people who maybe should be in jail who as a result of this aren't or had their records cleared.
We've talked about all this criminal behavior that went unnoticed by supervisors for so long. Is anything different today? Are there different systems, different attitudes today to prevent this type of corruption from flourishing?
That is a difficult question. I think that they're doing, through the consent decree, new training on stops and searches. So a lot of that conduct that we described, they're supposed to be addressing that. You know, I think that body cameras are an important thing here. It's important to note that body cameras weren't really online at the time of these crimes. They were for some of the officers towards the end of the investigation, but not all of them. And I think that, you know, I've got to think that some of this stuff would be more difficult with a camera rolling on their chest. However, they also showed the ability to do things sort of off the books and you know, not even on the clock. So, I mean, I'm not sure, you know, catching that it sounds pretty hard. You know, there's been different initiatives to stop plainclothes policing or to put them in different uniforms and different plans in place. And I think that, you know, that's a big question I have. How will we know when it's better? You know, it's like every administration is able to point to declining misconduct complaints. And yet we still have this process that, like I said earlier, doesn't have much transparency at all. We don't know what's going on. We just have to take their word for it. So I personally want to know, how will we know when it's better?
It's a big question. And this is a very impressive book. Thank you, Justin, for your reporting.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Justin Fenton covers criminal justice for the Baltimore Sun and was part of its Pulitzer Prize finalist team that reported on the death of Freddie Gray and the ensuing unrest. His book, We Own This City, A True Story of Crime, Cops, and Corruption, is the basis for an HBO limited series that will star John Bernthal, Josh Charles, and Jamie Hector. The TV series is being written and executive produced by David Simon and George Pelicanos. At the On the Record page at WIPR.org, we have links to an excerpt from the book and to some of Justin Fenton's reporting on the Gun Trace Task Force. I'm Sheila Cass, glad you're with us on the record on WIPR. Come back tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.